I want to know everything there is to know about you.
Now I'm going to introduce me.
You must have spotted her by now. She's always there.
Don't I deserve love?
Somebody has to like me best.
Hello, and welcome to the Don't Know Her podcast. I'm Michael.
And I'm Scott.
And we're back again after a tiny little break because, you know, girls gotta, I was gonna say eat, but we also need to be in the sun, go to music festivals, see Beyonce, yeah, live a life.
Yeah, lots going on.
And we're back with queer people.
Yay!
More queer people because, you know, the world, that's what we need.
Yes.
And we are starting with one of the great elders of the queer community.
Yeah, there we
although
go.
Although that's a loaded, loaded in lots of ways. But who is it we're talking about today?
We're talking about the, I mean, she is certainly iconic, more so now than she has ever been. It is, therefore, the iconic Miriam Margolyes.
Correct. And Miriam is kind of the person that kickstarted this trajectory of the next few episodes that we're going to do.
Yeah.
She is in many ways a face of British actually culture, but also like British sort of, I don't know what you try, like grumpy, like Victor Meldrew-esque, sort of like having these opinions that are a little bit wild, but because of their age and all that, they can get away with it. She just seems to be the face of this sort of, I don't know, this sort of character that I feel like is very British, if that makes sense. Also, she comes with a very posh accent. She is clearly well-educated. She will bitch about whoever she likes and gets away with it.
She sure does.
The Graham Norton show here in the UK is gagging to have her as a guest, obsessed, because they know she'll just say the most wild things and people will find that endearing somehow.
Yes, for sure. I mean, I reckon, I don't know the stats on it, but I reckon she must be at least one of the most frequent guests on that show now. And other shows like the currently troubled This Morning, she's features very, very frequently on that show.
She's someone I'd love to have a daily sort. You know the way we have that awful, what is it, GB News? Instead, we could have just MM News and just have her. I mean, a lot of it we wouldn't agree. Like, that's the thing about her. I don't think she is there to intend for people to agree with her or convert people. She's there with her opinions and she's unapologetic about them, but is usually, from my eyes anyway, respectful with them. So if that makes her endearing. She's also, I don't know if actually, we haven't talked about this, but in Ireland, she did like a show where she went around the country with this counsellor. And it's absolutely wonderful show.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I've only seen it online, so I don't know if it's an actual TV show or not. Should have done some research. But you know, what? Why would I do that? and she's really great crack. Yeah, she's learning Irish phrases and words and stuff. Yeah, and it's not the idea of a British lady going around Ireland, you know, mocking Irish culture a little bit would be awful. But somehow, like everything, she makes it so endearing.
She does, yeah, seem to make her curmudgeonly attitudes towards some things, yeah, sweet almost, even though she says many things with quite an acidic tongue. But the whole of the UK and Australia, she's also a citizen of Australia. I think both countries are very much into all of the Miriam content they can get now. So perfect for this podcast because in film, she's very familiar in that she's been in a lot of very high profile films, but certainly maybe hasn't been as utilised as you'd think, especially now knowing how well known she is. But it's like she's sort of been cashed in on in these past few years, big time, on television, but it's nice to look back at the film work she's done and the variety of things she's done. I mean, she's someone who's very, very proud of her vocal capabilities as an actor. She literally thinks she is the best in the business and no one is better than her except like impressionists.
Yeah.
She basically thinks that she's got it sewn up and no one sounds as good as her. So she has done a huge variety of accent work.
One of my favourite things that's going on in terms of her self-belief is the self-belief that Winona Ryder personally stole an Oscar nomination from her for The Age of Innocence, which Winona Ryder was nominated for Best Supporting Actress, but Miriam believes she should have been.
Yes.
And she won't let that go. So she may not know many celebrities, but I think she will never forget Winona Ryder.
For sure.
And I just love that. I love that self-confidence. And I think that's one of the reasons people love her.
Yeah.
And you're drawn to her because she's very comfortable in her skin,
yeah.
To quote Beyonce.
Yeah, no, she's...
Maybe Cozy is about trans women and Miriam.
Yeah, don't fuck with my sis. She's very, very outspoken. I think it's maybe just worth noting from the off that there are many opinions that Miriam holds that I'm sure you and I
definitely
don't agree with.
But you have opinions I don't agree with.
Well, there we go. We all do.
And I think that she brings that out too. Like,
she does note it.
She's not like a Jeremy Clarkson, why he's coming to bed, but he's not going to shut you down for an opinion. But she also won't shut herself down either.
No.
Which I know she has a platform and should maybe think more about what she's doing and her responsibility, but. Yeah, I think that you're right to flag it.
Yeah, but it is part of...
And when she's cancelled by the time this episode comes out, we absolutely do not stand with Miriam Margulies.
I think...
Awful woman.
It's something that could happen, but I think she's made too much of a name out of saying these things, owning these things, and putting it down to the fact that she is an older lady now, and these are the things she thinks, and she's going to let everyone know. But with that as well, she's very much a outspoken... queer person and will kind of own that. But it is interesting her talking about sexuality. It's not terribly simple for her, and how she believes coming out is a tricky thing, and she holds a lot of opinions there which are unusual perhaps to hear about today when talking about...
What do you mean? I just don't know what you're talking about.
So a few years ago she talked about coming out to her mother, and her mother having a stroke not long after, and she feels that she kind of may have, she hopes she didn't, but what if she did bring that on? And she speaks about there being a kind of maybe a sense of duty about realizing who you come out to. That side of it, I don't agree with. And she, even when she says it, she's like, I know most people disagree with me. My friend Ian McKellen certainly disagrees with me. So she does note that. So it's not necessarily the tidiest relationship. However, she's very vocal about it and will always kind of very openly discuss sexuality, sex, and all of these things to an extent that we certainly haven't had many other people do, that's for sure.
No, and she is very, you know, I don't know what age she is, I daren't guess, but you know that...
She'd be 82, I believe, yes.
So if I came out in 50 years ago in 1950s or 60s, like, I don't know. I don't know when she came out, so that maybe
I'm... Yeah, young, so but probably would have been the 50s.
You know, that experience is very different to what hopefully people are going through today. Sorry, it's not funny. I'm just thinking, if I gave my mum a stroke by coming out, well, first I'd be like, I've loved Kylie Minogue for so long. We go to watch, like, Bridget Jones's Diary in the cinema together, Moulin Rouge, whatever. You know, it's not that much of a shock.
Yeah, sure.
But anyway, sorry, that's also not a helpful statement in relation to anything.
Times have changed a huge amount, which we are all grateful for in the queer community.
I can't wait
to
be elderly so I can get away with statements like that.
Yeah, bide your time for another 40, 50 years.
Yeah, when we're on episode 2074 and we return to Miriam Margulies.
Yeah, watch yourself. That is going to be a real problematic in here.
And how would you first... how did you first get to know Miriam?
Well, I mean, almost certainly Harry Potter.
I'm so young.
I'm sure it had to be the second Harry Potter film where she plays Professor Sprout.
A very imaginative naming. I think we mentioned this already about J.K. Rowling naming characters. But honestly, when I read that again, I was like, even if I didn't know what Harry Potter was or the character... You can guess that she's from the ground, working with fucking plants or whatever those screaming things are. I'm so sorry. Those people love Harry Potter, including some listeners I know. And she's perfect in that film.
She is perfect. She is the right person. I mean, that is casting where it just completely makes sense when you talk about, like, and I mean this kindly, but from the ground, an earthy presence. I think Miriam delivers that. And as the herbology professor that she is, it just works very well. Her in the wee hat and commanding her greenhouse of students. It just seems to make sense and it works. So I certainly knew her face from there. It wouldn't have been long after that that I had seen her in other things, but for me, I'm confident it's there. What about you?
I couldn't wrap my head around how I first knew her. So I think she's been someone that's just always been famous to me because I remember seeing James and the Giant Peach. I remember our stepfather bringing us to see
it. Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I, watching a clip of it, so that's not a film I've watched recently. It's not like my sister's kids or anyone has ever reintroduced it to me. And watching Joanna Lumley and Miriam Margolyes play these two characters, I was like, I knew of them. And I remember thinking like Patsy and Abfab, and, you know, I was a young age, but I would have been able to make the links, or my parents certainly would have explained who they were. So then from that on, I kind of just knew who she was. So I just took her for granted in a way. So yeah, it didn't surprise me when she turned up in things like Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And then I really got to, or I got to have a feeling or connection to her in that TV show where she, like, the best exotic Marigold Hotel, but in real life.
Yes, exactly.
With her and Wayne Sleep and one of the cooking ladies. I'm so bad with those. Like, with films, I could rattle any name. I can't tell you about reality TV show.
I know.
But, and I don't watch reality TV show, as you know, but I love that show.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are some fabulous clips. The clip of her and Wayne Sleep at what I think is like a water park a swimming pool or something, and her use of foul language in that moment is stunning.
Yeah. There's so many really endearing bits and, like, really reflective.
Okay.
I've only watched it once. I'm making it sound like it's fucking a Martin Scorsese film or something, but it is. I really enjoyed it. So yeah. Other than that, I don't have much. I've not really thought much of Miriam Margolyes, although I'm very excited that we had her on our list, high up on our list for such a long time, and we finally get to talk about her.
Yeah, for sure. Glad to. All right, shall we jump in?
Yeah, and I've purposely not done any research, as I've already referred to you in this. So I'm really excited for you to spill. Like, I didn't know she was Australian.
So she is English. She's also of Polish descent, Polish and Belarus. So she's Jewish.
Mm. I've heard her views on Israel and Jews as well.
Yes, yes. She's very vocal
which is
about
a very
that.
Interesting thing to
yes. But she's only Australian because her partner is Australian. So she met her partner in 1968. So she's been with her partner for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. She keeps her partner very private. That's always something they agreed
like
on.
Like in a closet because of the stroke storyline. What? Is that what you mean? No. Just not like out of the limelight.
Out of the limelight. And I think by her partner Heather's choosing to remain that way. So her
Heather Burns at number 62.
I mean, the name is available, but I don't actually think she often will use her name, but it is out there. So I will do that. I'm doing
you are, this is like Angela Lansbury territory.
I wouldn't say it's quite that. But her partner is Australian, so she became Australian because of her partner. Yeah. So that is why she is a citizen Australian.
I'm only joking. That's lovely.
But I hope I can enlighten you into some other things, but now I feel there's too much pressure considering the...
I'll try nothing.
I really won't. But okay, so she was born on the 18th of May, 1941, in Oxford, England. Her father was from Glasgow and her mother Liverpool. So as I said, her family are Jewish, with her ancestors having moved to the UK from Poland and Belarus. But her parents were both also born in England. Well, no, her dad is Scottish, mum is English. They moved down to London. Then, as she was born during World War II, they moved out of London to Oxford to escape, you know, what probably was
war.
War was a terrible time to be in London.
Yeah.
She's convinced, based on what her mother has told her, that she was conceived during an air raid and cites that as the reason her hair is the way it is for whatever that.
Sorry, she was conceived during an air raid.
So, I mean, apparently things make people horny that I would have never anticipated, but, you know, it takes all sorts.
Well, when you're in the mood.
It, you know, gotta happen. So air raid sex equated to
Miriam
Margulies.
Is she the eldest person we've done on the podcast? I don't think we've gone as far back as World War II.
Well, we've done dead people. So,
Eleanor. Eleanor Parker,
would, if she was still with us, would be older. She might be the oldest living.
Anyway, that's boring for everyone to listen to. I will figure that out in a
minute. But there we go. So, moved to Oxford, and that's where she went to high school. So she went to Oxford High School. She attended Newham College at Cambridge. So yes, very well educated. She studied English there. And then we're going to hear a lot more kind of familiar things here for people who were educated there. So when she started acting, she starred in productions by the Cambridge Footlights. So she was in that crowd at the same time as the Monty Python fellas.
Of course.
Even though she says they were horrible, which she says of so many people. That I can certainly believe.
I was only recently talking about Monty Python and that being a real like culture shock to me of why the hell people like them.
Yeah.
Because I find them like very sort of toxic. I don't find it stupid. I don't get it. I hate when they start singing that song and From the Life of Brian. I do not understand Monty Python full stop. I do understand like them separate, if that makes sense. Love Michael Palin traveling, doing whatever he likes with his nice little accent. Love Fawlty Towers because Basil Fawlty is the butt of the joke and the women are more powerful. Love, even though he's an asshole, Terry Gilliam's, a lot of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't get it. So I agree with Miriam. I'm glad. And that's why I was like, what if they had worked together? Because her energy would have worked, but it would have improved what they were doing.
Yeah, and that's what I think she says. I mean, I think she called them something to the effect of very average private school boys. And they thought
they
were way better. But she was like, you know, I'm sure John Cleese was a genius. Don't think he is anymore. She says all of these things.
Yeah.
But was like they were very snobbish about her working with them. They didn't quite fit what they were after. However, she was like, I'm funny, I'm clever, and I'm good at that stuff. So it did work, and probably, like you're saying, made anything that they might have done together better.
What a shame. I feel like there would have been opportunities there.
Yeah, there certainly should have been, perhaps. So an interesting thing to flag, for sure. We kind of get... this is a story that probably became known way after the fact, but the beginnings of sort of the Miriam we know now would have happened around this time too. So while representing the Newham College on the very first ever series of University Challenge, she is cited, and she also says herself too, as one of the first people to say fuck on British television.
Ooh.
Now, not recorded, as in the sound was not there, but you apparently could see her mouthing the word fuck when she got the question wrong. But it still makes her one of the first people, apparently, on British TV to say the word fuck. And I think that's only apt now, considering the language we see her use on television very frequently.
Yeah. It's all her fault.
It all started from there. Miriam's first film role came in 1969's A Nice Girl Like Me, but she first gained recognition as a voice recording artist. So she was a storyteller in the very, very iconic for our, I guess, parents and older generation, British kids TV show called Jack and Ori, which is where people tell stories to children. So she was in 10 episodes of that, I believe, as the storyteller, and maybe played some parts in amongst the storytelling as well. But then in stark contrast to that, in the 70s, she recorded a soft porn audio called Sexy Sonia, Leaves from My Schoolgirl Notebook, which I have heard her talk about as well. An amusing reflection on that, for sure. She'd then perform most of the supporting female characters in English dubs of a couple of Japanese TV series, actually. One which was an action TV show called Monkey, and then another called The Water Margin. And then around this time, too, and very important to her as an out queer performer, she worked with a theatre company called the Gay Sweatshop, and their purpose was to make heterosexuals aware of the oppression they exercise or tolerate, and expose and end media misinterpretations of homosexuals. So she would have done a few productions with them. I think that was the beginnings of her moving back into London and performing there, because I believe they were based out of South London, if my research was correct. In 1974, she appeared with a podcast favourite, Kenneth Williams, and another carry-oner, Ted Ray, in the BBC Radio 2 comedy series, The Betty Witherspoon Show.
I bet they had a great old time.
I hope they did. I hope that was a nice one. I hope, you know, if she was to talk about him, she's not like, God, he's awful.
I don't want to hear her opinion on Kenneth Williams.
No. But I'm sure she'd love him, because she does often also speak very warmly of people she's worked with. So I hope that would be one of them. She herself, though, cites her breakthrough as coming in three episodes of The Girls of Slender Means, which was in 1975. Her first major film role came as a character called Elephant Ethel, which does sound to be very, very cruel to me, in a film called Stand Up Virgin Soldiers from 1977. And looking at the poster, it sort of gives me carry-on type energy. So I imagine it sort of sits within that kind of wheelhouse.
And from the poster, are the soldiers female or male?
I think the soldiers are male.
Okay.
Yes.
This just makes me...
Per Elephant Ethel.
Concerned for Elephant Ethel.
The 1980s saw her feature in various Blackadder episodes. So this is probably where she was really becoming very well known.
And was Rowan Atkinson in that sort of bubble too? Sorry, I don't know why I'm like...
He may well have been. I don't actually know where he studied, but...
I thought you would know.
I'm so sorry, but he feels like you...
Yeah, he feels like the same. And that's a great fit.
But maybe, certainly younger than them, though, Rowan Atkinson,
I can't, because he's so out of public eye, I've no...
Yeah, no, he definitely would be younger than the sort of Monty Python, Miriam. Yeah, for sure. So she was in the first Blackadder series as the Spanish Infanta. She was in...
Is that Spanish for elephant? Because
it's Elephant Ethel again.
Rowan loved you as Elephant Ethel. Can you bring her back?
Just brought her back. She was Lady Whiteadder in Blackadder the second, or is it two? I can't remember. And as Queen Victoria in Blackadder's Christmas Carol.
I love it.
Wouldn't be the last time she would actually play Queen Victoria. I think she was... cast as that in many sort of bit parts and like children's TV shows and stuff thereafter.
As if she's like a mannequin for hire. She looks like her. Bring her out.
She'll do it. In 1982, she starred in The Fabulous Scrubbers, which we have discussed before on this podcast. That's a film following a young woman offender's prison. We spoke about that when we discussed Kathy Burke.
Really fun movie.
It's a really
and I think
good
about
one.
That fondly, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good one, so definitely worth checking out. There's quite the cast in there, including Pam St. Clements, and I feel very glad to say that, considering I spent this weekend wearing a Pat Butcher t-shirt. In 1983, she was in Yentl. She played a character called Sarah. I can't say I've ever actually seen Yentl, so I can't speak to how big that...
What's his name? Oh, my God, so gorgeous. The guy from Homeland and beautiful singer from Sunday in the Park with George.
Mandy Patinkin.
Yeah. Sorry, also Barbra Streisand, big vehicle for her. Yeah. Interesting, because, you know, that's queerish, questioning gender, you know. Am I thinking of the right film?
Yeah, exactly. And Jewish.
And Jewish, of course.
So, obviously, all important things, I'm sure.
Clearly didn't like Barbara if they didn't work together again, did they?
Well, things aren't always simple.
Or maybe Babs didn't like her. I can imagine Miriam and... imagine
best friends.
Yeah, maybe they are.
No, they did work together again.
Oh, did they? Amazing.
They were in
oh my God,
trip.
In The Guilt Trip. And I remember watching that film and being delighted because there's someone else amazing at that table. She's literally in it for one scene being like, maybe you should go on this trip with your son.
Well, maybe they are pals
I love
then.
The Guilt Trip. We'll get to that.
1986, she had a major role in the BBC series The Lives and Loves of a She-Devil as Nurse Hopkins. That was a... something that was remade as She-Devil, which starred Meryl Streep not many years after that, actually.
Did she play the Miriam part?
I don't actually know, but that would have been worth looking into.
That would have been fun. And then Miriam could have something wrong with Meryl Streep, too.
He probably stole my part, the bitch. And then she was a dental nurse in Little Shop of Horrors.
Yes,
also that's
so
year.
Fun.
So fun.
With Steve Martin and Bill Murray in a really, like, you have seen Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, it's a delight. What a film. It's, yeah. I mean, in her career is peppered with these little sort of gems where she probably does pop up, not for too long, but it's like, woo, that is a delightful thing to have on the filmography. Now, in 1987, we see her star as Flora Finching in Little Dorrit. Now, for this, she picks up the Los Angeles Film Critics Award for Supporting Actress. This film's an Oscar-nominated adaptation of the Charles Dickens novel. The Oscar nominations for it came for Supporting Actor for Alec Guinness and Screenplay for the writer-director Christine Edzard. Now, this one's interesting to me. I sadly have not seen it, so I'm going to hand over to you in a moment to talk about it. But I'm very interested because this film was made primarily at the Sands Film Studios, which is in Rotherhithe, which is just around the corner from where Michael and I are recording this very moment, because we both live in the vicinity. And this studios were founded by Christine, who is the writer-director of Little Dorrit. So very, very exciting. But a very long film. I think cited as one of the longest running times a film has
Yeah, it's 343 minutes. In two parts?
Yeah.
Arguably, it is two parts, although the DVD I got didn't really suggest that.
Okay, it just carried on.
No. There's two, because it's so long, it's on two discs.
Okay, okay.
But I don't know, actually. No, they are given different names, so fair enough. It's just, in a way, It did end. Sorry, I'm lying. It is clearly two parts.
Okay.
And when I read the reviews and everything, they were saying, like your mate Roger Ebert was saying, you should see these both in the same day.
So it must
have been two, but released in the same time, not like this sort like Dune or something now.
And was it released, like it must have been a film release given that it was
in
cinema release for Oscar nominations.
It seemed to be cinemas, yeah. So Little Dorrit is a Charles Dickens adaptation. It follows the story of, that's so wild, if I spent that much time, and I can't think what the man's character is, he has a quite annoying name anyway, but played by Derek Jacobi, and the first part follows his return to London after his father's death, and he's like a merchant, and they're in London, and then he has a disagreement with his mother, and he spots Little Dorrit, who's played by Sarah Pickering, who was very young and hasn't done much else acting-wise. And anyway, the first part follows him as he engages with London of the time, and there's a... I forget actually what it was called. It's like basically like where you can't pay your debts, so you're put in sort of a jail, but it's a town. It's like a little town. Okay. Apparently it was really a big thing back then. A big thing, not in a good way. So like that's where Little Dorrit lives with her father, played by Alec Guinness, who owes a lot of debts, but has a good name. So Little Dorrit is working as a housemaid in Derek Jacobi's family home. And like, I'm not joking when I say that is the story, really. Like you meet all these different characters, including Miriam Margolyes, she's a married kind of socialite. She's very sort of chatty and bubbly and lovely. And then the first part ends, and the second part is the same story through Little Dorrit's eyes.
Oh, right.
And...
oh, that's fascinating.
So, let me start with saying it is so televisual. It is a very televisual film. Like, it really surprised me that, like what you're saying, that it was on cinema screens. By today's standards, you wouldn't have that. Like, it wouldn't work.
No, sure.
Even when you look at, like, theatre productions, like, how they're recorded, you wouldn't do that. And even when it comes to TV of that length, you know, you want to, you know, Mayor of Easttown or Big Little Lies, you'd be a beautiful thing. But it lent itself, the whole thing, like, this kind of essence of theatre. And I found it so wonderful. And even though, like, it's filmed around here and clearly they were using the same spots for different locations,
right.
I found it all kind of magical. I didn't watch it all in one day. I did watch the first part all the way through, and then I watched the second part in two sittings. But I found it really moving. I really, really liked it.
Good.
I will say it's totally creepy and like really weird, the age gap between Little Dorrit and Derek Jacobi. And that's the part of the movie I don't even think then would I just don't think that's okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. It must be like 30 years. Like she's a young, she's like 16 and they or something, and they keep referring to it. And okay. It's like, no, leave her alone. And the way he kind of gives money, lends money to help her, but then she's indebted to him. It's all very questionable. But the whole essence of the characters and people popping in and out and seeing different characters through the different eyes of the main character's story in the two parts is incredible. And I really was relieved when Miriam Margolyes came in, because some of the actors are a bit dry and boring, I will say. I won't name names. But then Miriam Margolyes comes in, Murray Melvin comes in, all these people come in and they're like, wow, this is like life. And Alec Guinness is superb. I loved it, yeah. And I think Miriam Margolyes is terrific. She's so lovely. And when she's in the second part, like, for instance, this is the beauty of the movie. In the first part, you'll see her chatting away to Derek Jacobi. And Little Dorrit is in the room too. And then Little Dorrit moves away. But you keep stay with Miriam Margolyes and you hear her the whole time. In the second part, you hear a little bit of that conversation, but only the bit Little Dorrit hears. But you know, because you've watched the first part, what you're missing. And it kind of gives you more texture to this world. So I've never read Little Dorrit, nor do I know what it's like. So I don't assume the book was written that way. But it's a really great way to tell that story. And it really made me want to see, like, at the National Theatre, on the Olivier stage, a six-hour Little Dorrit.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing.
If we have to do Dickens, please stop doing A Christmas Carol something else. And I think Little Dorrit, if you change the ages, there's a really beautiful story of, like, human need and connection. And, like, what is life? What is a community? What is a city? How does it interact? What are your morals? I was really taken by it.
And a lot of what I've read around it, the reviews I've seen of it, are incredibly positive, and other people who have watched it fairly recently really responding to it as well. And based on what you're saying, I'm therefore not surprised that she was nominated for her screenplay, because that would make sense. It sounds like she's done something very
really
adventurous.
Worth it, yeah. I will say, someone else maybe could have directed it better, but I don't... Like, in the hands, I was thinking, like, I mean, David Lean would have been an obvious person, but there's people that really could have elevated the whole thing, but the script is where it really works, and some of the performances. I do, like, thinking on it and, like, where Miriam getting awards or nominations for it, it's actually Joan Greenwood, who plays the mother of Derek Jacobi, who, particularly in the second half, is absolutely wonderful.
Right, okay.
I don't know, she's a really... brilliant British actress. She was in Girls on Top. She played like the landlady. She had used to have like big fur feather hat.
Yes, okay.
A very specific sort of posh English accent. Sadly, I guess we'd never really do her on this podcast because we don't really cover that sort of star, but she's terrific. And Miriam is, when she's on screen, which is out of 343 minutes, let's say 20 minutes, is terrific.
Yeah, okay, amazing. And the reviews I'd read as well were very... into what Miriam was bringing, so as one of they cited her as a highlight of the thing. So
you know,
good.
Like in Jane Austen, you'll have a character who chats more than they realize they're chatting, and then they'll be like, "Oh my god, well you're not even talking." Da, da, da. That is what she's doing.
Okay.
It's like da 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 da. The speed of it, the energy. She's a busybody who, because she's married and doesn't have kids or whatever yet, doesn't have anything, any purpose. She just will be nonstop chatting and trying to solve problems.
Mr. Glenham, you insincerest of creatures. I perceive already you haven't lost your old way of paying compliments when you used to pretend to be so sentimentally struck, you know. At least I don't mean that. Oh, I don't know what I mean. Oh, no, no, you mustn't leave yet. You would never be so unkind as to think of going, Arthur. I suppose Mr. Glenham would be more proper.
Oh, and I assume that relationship must have been good between her and the writer-director, because... she did then appear in, I believe, a few other of the Sands Films productions. Michael and I went and saw A Taste of Honey recently at this studio. And before it, because it was in celebration of Murray Melvin, they showed a few clips. And Miriam did crop up in at least one other one that wasn't Little Dorrit, I believe.
Was that they seem obsessed with Charles Dickens, because wasn't there another Charles Dickens
yes.
where Murray Melvin played Charles Dickens?
Well, yeah, they must have been obsessed with Charles Dickens. Miriam Margolyes is also obsessed with Charles Dickens, so it all makes sense. In fact, in 1989, Miriam would keep that appreciation going by co-writing and starring in a one-woman show called Dickens Women. where she played 23 characters from Dickens novels. It was something that was developed for the Edinburgh Festival before being taken around the world. It received a huge amount of acclaim, especially for her. She was nominated for an Olivia Award for her work in it. And this was, I think, one of many things she would then do in celebration of Charles Dickens' work. She's done documentary series on more than one occasion, I believe two or three even, covering different areas of Dickens' work.
Okay, so I just said we shouldn't have any more Christmas Carol, but why the hell would she not be cast as Scrooge?
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't
gosh.
Want, you know,
that is
that,
literally
yeah,
perfect.
That would be perfect.
I'll jump ahead to the end.
Yes, I might keep that to the end. It's better than what I have written down, yeah.
Moving on to 1990, we see her in a Lawrence Kasdan film titled I Love You to Death, and she plays a realtor in the thriller Pacific Heights. 1991 sees her in The Butcher's Wife. And then 92, there's an interesting one. So she was cast as the lead in a US sitcom called Franny's Turn. It didn't last very long, but it was the first sitcom that the now iconic American sitcom creator Chuck Lorre made. So that was his first sitcom. He's then gone on to do, I mean, many of them, I'm not a fan of the likes of The Big Bang Theory, but a lot of the big hitter sitcoms that have come out over the past 20 plus years.
Chuck Berry, is that what you call him?
Chuck Lorre.
Lorre.
not Chuck Berry, although a very
Chuck
talented
Berry,
person.
Else? Oh.
He is a guitarist musician.
How's that? I don't know where he got in my head, but...
Well, he's a good one, so that's okay. Now to 93, so here's a big one. She starred as Mrs. Mingott in Martin Scorsese's The Age of Innocence. So this would see Miriam win a BAFTA Award for Supporting Actress, and like earlier discussed, presumed that she should have also been nominated for the Oscar, which that devil woman Winona Ryder stole from her. So obviously this in the career of Miriam is a big one for her. She cites working with Martin Scorsese as a massive, massive deal for her, and really respected his approach to working and the seriousness of it and kind of the magic of working with him. So is delighted that that is something that has happened in her career. But yeah, I know it's a firm favourite of yours, so why don't you take it away with The Age of Innocence?
I feel like I'm just going to take over this episode in
That's
terms of Little Darlings, but Age of Innocence is one of my favourite movies of all time, and I mean that in terms of like top five, not in terms of like 100.
Okay.
I think Age of Innocence is a perfect movie.
Love it.
I think it's Martin Scorsese's best film. I think it gives some of the has some of the best performances from a very talented cast. But sorry, the story, I guess I should, before I just keep saying how much I love it, is about Michelle Pfeiffer returns to New York society, leaving her husband. She gets to stay with her cousin, I believe, Winona Ryder.
Yeah.
And her mother, played by Geraldine Page, who we've covered on the podcast. And Winona
Geraldine Chaplin.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Chuck Berry, Chuck whatever. Geraldine Chaplin. And Winona Ryder is freshly engaged, to Daniel Day-Lewis. He wears a white flower. Michelle Pfeiffer is wearing a red flower. They're at the opera. Shit's gonna go down. So there, Daniel Day-Lewis has a connection to Michelle Pfeiffer. Michelle Pfeiffer is struggling to stay afloat in society, where being a separated woman, no matter what the instance, is totally not acceptable. It follows their story. It's kind of about nothing, but it's about everything. So this society is all kind of, it's a balancing act, which we see in many different forms across the movie. And it is the character's journey to try and stay afloat and trying to find fulfillment for their passions. And yeah, I think it's absolutely wonderful. Like, on the face of it, a surface, it sounds like any other sort of, you know, period drama. But I think the way Martin Scorsese, firstly, Edith Wharton wrote the novel that it's based on. And I love Edith Wharton, who also did House of Mirth, Ethan Frome, like lots of books that I really like. So it's a great source material. But what Martin Scorsese has managed to do is like really elevate it to be like a gangster film almost. Like, everything is so important in this movie. And it is stylized, but it's not like distractingly so. So like, there's moments in it where, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis goes to talk to Michelle Pfeiffer in the opera house, and there's noise and everyone's bustling. It's just before the performance is about to begin again, and you get a spotlight on them and everything goes silent as they converse very quietly, which A, gives is a very, you know, beautiful thing to look, but also like gives you a sense of like you're in on their little secret, like you're on this journey. And I love it. Miriam is absolutely brilliant in it. She plays kind of like the elder statesperson of this society. So she can dictate when people get married.
And when's the wedding to be?
Oh, as soon as ever it can, if only you'll back me up, Mrs. Mingott.
We must give them time to get to know each other a little better, Mama.
Know each other? Everybody in New York has always known everybody. Don't wait till the bubble's off the wine. Marry them before Lent. I may catch pneumonia any winter now, and I want to give the wedding breakfast.
But yeah, I really like it. I mean, I did make a whole list of like 10 things I love about it, but what do you think about it before
okay,
I do that?
Well, yes, because we definitely want to hear that. I think it's wonderful as well. I think it's a really great thing that Martin Scorsese has this in his film canon, because against everything else, it stands out in a peculiar way, because it feels like a swerve for him, but he felt connected to this material because for him it is about sort of brutality in a very different way, and him allowing to tell a story about brutality, which we've seen him cover in, you know, very different fashions, in this just beautiful film. It just feels so poured over and thoughtful. Everyone's at the top of their game in it.
Yeah.
Michelle Pfeiffer, I wonder if this is her at her best, because she's so good in this.
How she did not, if Miriam wants to go on about Oscars, yeah. Like, Michelle Pfeiffer, I mean, anyway, is great in loads of things, but this, I honestly can't comprehend, A, how the film wasn't celebrated, but she is amazing. Like, amazing. Like, that is as good as any performance in any movie. I don't give a fuck about Daniel Lewis in There Will Be Blood or Lincoln or, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio, like, you know, being a vegetarian and eating meat or whatever for The Revenant. What Michelle Pfeiffer is doing in Age of Innocence is as good as anything. Right. And I find it wild that she would be ignored. I mean, the film being ignored, but watching any one of her scenes, like, she is so good at this sort of, like, vulnerable woman on the verge. See Catwoman also.
Well, there we go. They're both solid. Miriam is wonderful here. And this is a real standout in her filmography too, because we've never gotten to see her do something like this, where it's just, you can feel her relishing it so much, kind of being that source of wisdom and delivering this wonderful dialogue through pursed lips. Her accent is very, very fun. Yes, she's really magnetic in it, and therefore I'm glad that she did at least win the BAFTA, and she is getting some acknowledgement there. Other people in it, Geraldine Chaplin, she has such presence in this. And gosh, what's
Sean Phillips?
Yes,
oh, amazing. My God. Yeah. Like, so I've watched this film a lot, and actually, watching it for this, Sean Phillips really stood out to me.
Yeah, she's wonderful. It's just so much memorable work going on here, and the cinematography and the production design. Wow! There's these shots of what New York would have looked like at this time, in these sort of suburbs and these mansions and this sparse kind of land surrounding them. It's so stunning to look at. So I think it's terrific, but I do want to hear your list of especially why this makes it a top five film for you.
Well, to be honest, I've kind of just focused on little moments because I kind of struggle with the immensity. But Michelle Pfeiffer has been like shunned by society, and Daniel Day-Lewis goes to so much effort to get her into the room, and everyone's being very polite and doing all the usual things. She enters in a red dress when everyone else is wearing very conservative colors, still putting on her jewelry, not ready to go to this, but like not doing what everyone else. Then she, as Daniel Day-Lewis is a kind of beginning to find an attraction to her, and it's like, oh, like looking at her, talking to someone else. She does, as the voiceover says, what no woman would do, and leaves those men to go and sit with Daniel Day-Lewis, and then jokes about how boring they are and how she should put up with them. And there's something about like having such a contemporary sort of character in a world like that that is so exciting. I don't think there's many examples of that in, like, you could argue in Austin and stuff like that, but not quite the same way. Like, and when I watched as a teenager for the first time, I resonated so much with what Michelle Pfeiffer was going through in terms of like, I'm in a society where I don't feel like I could do these things, but fuck it, I'm going to anyway. You know, like when I came out at 13 and all this sort of stuff, I will walk across that room. So I absolutely love that. I mean, I could just go on and on. To be honest, I've just written a lot about Michelle Pfeiffer doing lots of different things. Everyone having their binoculars looking at her in the opera house and then her not looking back at them. I could go on and on. It is absolutely brilliant. And I should say, because I've just talked about Michelle Pfeiffer, I think Winona Ryder is a very worthy Best Supporting Actress nominee. Okay. She plays this kind of dutiful wife who you think's a bit naive, but really isn't, very, very well. And I think that is maybe the hardest part of all, because the film rests on her character going through motions that we see towards the end of the film, and makes the ending, which is very sad, even sadder.
Mm.
I think the ending is absolutely beautiful. Yeah, it is one of my, honestly, it's one of my favorite endings, one of my favorite films. I would watch that any day of the week. Like, I just went to the Prince Charles to watch it on film, whatever, like 3 months ago, and was delighted then it was on Netflix so I could watch it again.
Yeah. Oh, the ending sequence is stunning. Yeah.
And I think Daniel Day-Lewis, who I've not really mentioned in terms of himself, he's perfect in
it
too.
Yes, he is. He is perfect here. It completely makes sense. He cuts the perfect figure, both in terms of the placement in this period, but standing out so much,
And getting away with it? Like, because he's actively a feminist. Like, even by today's standards, some of the stuff he's saying in response to what's being thrown about in terms of Michelle Pfeiffer's character, he's still like a hero in a way, but not for himself, and that's where the tragedy comes. Yeah. Like, it makes me like emotional. I just want to stop this and go watch it again.
I love that so much. I mean, I just watched it too, but you've like resold it to me, so I would like to also go and watch it again.
And maybe it is because I've watched it so much, I get so much out of it. Yeah. But yeah, next time, honestly, the way Michelle Pfeiffer enters, putting on that bracelet, the look on her face, she doesn't care about Daniel Day-Lewis making all, or she does, but she's so excited, she just wants to go to the ball. I love it.
Oh, fabulous. Oh, The Age of Innocence. For those of you who have not seen The Age of Innocence, I think you have a...
It's on Netflix. Well, it is in the UK.
On Netflix in the UK at the moment, and it's obviously coming with our highest recommendation.
I actually hate it.
Oh, you big faker. Okay, sadly then, we move on. In 1994, she stars in the Beethoven biopic Immortal Beloved.
I thought you were going to say Beethoven the dog movie.
Yeah, she plays Beethoven the dog. No, she doesn't. In 1995, though, she does play a dog. Now, I was saying before, which is still true, the first place I knew her from was Harry Potter. But had I known her voice and placed it, this is certainly the first place she would have been present to me. So she voices Fly the Collie in George Miller's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful Babe.
You've got to be a brave boy now. I left my mother when I was your age, and my pups will have to leave me soon. But I'll keep an eye on you if you like, just till you find your feet.
Of all of the fun voice work in Babe, hers is the strongest because she really, really, really brings, for someone who doesn't have children and also openly dislikes children, she is so maternal. Her voice is just wonderful in this. Mm. Love it. Love Babe. She reprises the role in 98's sequel, Babe Pig in the City. Also wonderful. George Miller's output, endlessly fascinating. Going back to 96, Miriam plays Aunt Sponge, as you mentioned earlier, and voice the glowworm in Henry Selick's live-action / stop-motion crossover James and the Giant Peach. But it was also that same year that we see her as the nurse in Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet. Now, I don't feel like we need to say what Romeo and Juliet is about, the obvious source material here. It is a direct adaptation in terms of the language, but in terms of everything else around it, it is very, very contemporary. Very Baz Luhrmann. It tells the story of the two star-crossed lovers, the most famous of all time, coming from their warring families. They should not be together. However, young love stands up against that, and everything that we know of Romeo and Juliet follows. But this is the one starring Leo DiCaprio and Claire Danes as our titular lovers. I am not a fan of Romeo and Juliet anyway. I always think I'm going to come back to Romeo plus Juliet and watch it and realise how brilliant it is, because many people seem to. I just don't, and I think it's just because I don't care enough about the source material, and I find it to be too eye-rolling. Now, I know I'm in the minority in that, because it is one of the most beloved texts of all time. There is things I appreciate in it. There are great performances. We've talked about this before when we spoke about John Leguizamo. He's wicked in it.
Literally
wicked. Everyone, the music choices are very, very fun. Mm. Giving Desiree that kind of moment, respect forever for that, Baz. Well done, what a choice. Wicked, love it, love it, love it. However, all in all, it just doesn't do what I always really, really want it to. I want it to because it feels so kinetic and electric and exciting. Miriam as the nurse, I enjoy immensely, though. I think she, again, is sort of perfect as the sort of dutiful person in Juliet's life. She is her nurse. However, she sees the love and she is helping her go against the expectation of the family and helps her on her journey.
Nurse, thou knowest my daughter is of a pretty age.
I was the prettiest babe that there I nursed.
By my count, I was your mother much upon these years. You are now a maid. Oh, thus then in brief. The valiant Paris seeks you for his love.
A man, young lady. Lady, such a man as all the world. Why, he's a man of what?
Verona's summer hath not such a flower.
Nay, he's a flower in faith, a very flower.
And I really feel it from her, even though there's moments it kind of leans into caricature that works with the Baz Luhrmann material, but she does bring such warmth that it just really, really works. So I think this is wonderful work from Miriam. I believe you're a much bigger fan of this film than I am.
Oh yeah, I love Baz Luhrmann, and I find it infectious, the sort of world he creates, particularly when it is a simple sort of love story like that, or Moulin Rouge or Strictly Ballroom. So for sure, and I agree everything you've said about Miriam. It's like Jim Broadbent in Moulin Rouge, similar sort of having to 1 minute be a one-note character, then having all of the, you know, depth of any sort of human and more in the next moment. Yeah, she's really good, and I think fondly of it. It's very iconic as also that film, but sadly not maybe for the nurse. But she's good, like. Yeah, for a character that could easily be forgettable, like, she's really good.
Yeah, and I think this is... So often on this podcast, we talk about, you know, character actors, actresses. And where that feels appropriate and not appropriate. Again, character actress is something that Miriam owns, and she, it's actually quite, it's touching, it may be a little bit sad how she talks about it. It is, it, for her, as simple as she's like, I'm she's short not, and I'm ugly, I'm not beautiful, so therefore I was never going to be the lead, and that's okay because I like getting the work I do. And sometimes, yes, a lead will crop up that sort of works within what I can do and what I can bring to the screen, but I'm not a leading lady. And, you know, I wasn't designed to be a leading lady. And when you see her in something like this, I think it's like, okay, but when people also understand the weight that you can bring to being as talented a character performer as she is, then it works so well.
I would agree, because Miriam Margolyes is someone, when reflecting for this podcast, I wouldn't say she is the most talented actor to not be given lead parts.
Yes.
I also, like, when she says character actor, like, if my opinion of a character actor is someone who, like, hides, and I don't think she ever, I think that's part of it, unless it's voice work. But I think you're getting a personality on purpose, you know?
Yeah.
So I do think it's a shame. So it's interesting, yeah. I do think she could definitely have done way more in her career. I think it's wonderful, the work that she has done, particularly the stuff that we've highlighted so far. But it is a shame. It's a shame when you ever hear anybody reflect on themselves that way.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it is a shame. She just seems to do it with such kind of like a knowingness. It's almost like you don't want to do the whole sort of like, no, yeah, you're wrong. That, yeah. She's just like, it's what I think and that's that. So end of story.
And she's not lying. I don't think there's many places in terms of, like, she's not lying in terms of the film industry. I don't know where those parts would have come if someone to, you know, like, even Judi Dench struggled until they made Mrs. Brown. Yeah. And that was for TV, and Harvey Weinstein made that a thing. And without that, she would not be who she is now.
It's such a good point,
So I don't know then where Miriam Margolyes fits in.
No, I think that's a really kind of good comparison point. But I think she is a realist, and, you know, she does talk a lot of truths for sure. So, you know, I think she just recognises her place within the industry and, you know, will strive to get her most out of it for sure. Like, she, in certain points in her career, literally calls out for roles. So respect to her for that.
Yeah.
98, then, we also see her using that terrific voice again as the matchmaker in Disney's Mulan. In 19...
A brilliant character. I love the oh my God, what is the song when they... Like, that Mulan song's my favourite. I know everyone sings Reflection, whatever, but the song where they're getting... It's like... Dun, 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 at the beginning. Gosh, and the matchmaker's so good.
Yeah.
That's so awful, I can't remember it, but that's the only song of Mulan I'd listen to.
Well, in 1999, she stars opposite Ralph Fiennes in Sunshine, which in an interview from about 10 years ago, she cites as one of her favourite film roles of her own. So I'm sad I only came to that knowledge today, because I probably would have tried to seek it out if she feels it is a standout. Or maybe it was just to work on it. She got a lot out of it. But either way,
I feel like someone we just did starred in that film too.
Yeah, so Jennifer Ely was in Sunshine. Oh, yeah.
Everyone's in Sunshine.
Everyone. 2002, let's skip on to there. Miriam, here, this is where we have her sitting amongst many giants of British cinema, taking on the role of Professor Sprout in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. The role we see her reprise even more briefly than she was in the Chamber of Secrets in 2011's The Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Where would you rank her out of all the character actors in Harry Potter? Really the only way I can do, like, Harry Potter, we don't even need to talk about it. It's about a boy wizard who has, for some reason, the chosen boy, and he is going to defeat Ralph Fiennes in prosthetics to save the world.
I think that was all that was written on this sort of initial brief
for her nappy.
Yeah. Where do I rank her?
I feel like back in the day they were like, and now here's some more celebrities for the, you know, the geeks or the older people, the parents, to bring their kids to see.
I think that's a very hard thing to do, only because the casting, I guess you can say whatever you want about Harry Potter films, the casting was pretty genius across the board. I really do think, even though a lot of it's very obvious, of course, the kind of, many familiar faces, which were of course going to show up dead. But
you say that, but I don't know.
No, but there's plenty. Yeah. Yes, there's plenty who don't, and there's people like the aforementioned Derek Jacobi who cites it as a huge error in not taking a role he was offered in the Harry Potter series. Dumbledore, apparently, along with many other famous thesps like Sir Ian McKellen, of course, which does feel very obvious. But
I quite like, I'm not a huge fan of Michael Gambon in general, but I think he's quite good as Dumbledore.
Think he's wonderful.
He does that Irish twang like Richard Harris really well. I mean, if Richard Harris was still around, I'd still love him to do the whole thing.
Richard Harris was terrific in the first two. But for me, Gambon, I don't know, brings an oddity that I do really love. So I'm very happy that they were the ones who...
So basically what you're telling me is it's Julie Christie as the barmaid and then Miriam Margolyes in terms of your ranking of Harry Potter stars.
But even all... gosh, there's just so many great... Yeah, it is just a wonderful
thing. Well, who's your favourite? Is that easier?
Maggie.
I guess she wasn't really a selling point in this. Yeah, but what I meant was more like people coming in and selling
it. People coming in... in smaller parts, well, Imelda is Umbridge.
God help
is,
us.
Like, the best because it's...
If Avengers did shit like that, I'd be watching more Avenger movies, you know? Like, bring in Imelda Staunton as some conservative woman with a wand.
Yeah, but there's so many... I'm trying to think of smaller ones. Emma Thompson is Professor Trelawney's wonderful.
I think you'll be surprised by my actual one.
Oh, who is it?
Kenneth Branagh. And he's in the same film, no, as Miriam Margolyes?
Yes, and he is. I'm very surprised that you would choose him as a favourite. He is perfect. The person who I believe they offered that part to originally would have also been interesting was Hugh Grant.
Oh, that would have been funny. But then I think that would have taken away from Paddington 2 if we'd seen him.
There we go.
So
yes.
I think it all worked out.
It all worked out great.
And I also think Kenneth Branagh's less in on the joke, like that he is cast because he's in real life a bit like that character of like doesn't understand his own sense of celebrity and importance.
Yeah, it's
so I think that's why I think it's perfect, whereas Hugh Grant does understand.
Yeah.
Actually, Hugh Grant doesn't really have that, I guess. But Kenneth Branagh certainly is that. What's his name? I wouldn't call him like something to do with his hair, locks.
Gilderoy Lockhart.
Lockhart. Again, JK just was like, locks of hair, heart, Lockhart.
Oh,
that's... I should stop bad-mouthing her for those writing choices and more for her trans opinions.
That's,
but
that's
anyway, it's easier to attack her for the writing. Anyway, that's enough about Harry Potter. And
Miriam's great. She's there for not too long like many others.
No, and at the end, she's really important because she helps Gemma Jones and Emma Thompson touch students in a wide shot. Like, she's trying to help them or something. I don't know what she's doing.
Perfect.
Herbology stuff?
Yeah. So.
Giving them weed? It'll be easier if you take this. Don't mind the villains over there. It's just Helen McCrory and Ralph Fiennes and Helen Bonham Carter.
Because you say, God, this casting, it's always to me, it blows my mind. Anywho. Also in 2002, whether you care or not, she was awarded an OBE for her services to drama.
Oh. Are you talking about me or who? Anybody.
Anyone.
No, OBEs are fun, aren't they? But I don't know what it means.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
I guess you're discounting Nando's. Surely it gets you something. Surely you get invited to some party.
Must be.
How does Emma Thompson get to the coronation? Is she an OBE? Oh,
she's
a dame.
Dame.
Yeah, I love her. She tells, like, bitches about the royal family and whatever, and then A, takes a damehood and then goes to coronation. Yeah. What the fuck's going on there?
No, I think she loves it. All right, 2004, we see Miriam playing Peg Sellers, the mother of Peter Sellers, in The Life and Death of Peter Sellers.
Really good movie. And was released as a film here, yeah.
Oh,
it was
okay.
A TV film in America with Jeffrey Rush and Charlize Theron. Yeah, I really like that.
Oh, good, okay.
For who cares, no one? Well, I guess if you're listening to this, you might care.
Yeah, maybe you will, for completists. she'd also starring the even better than that, Chasing Liberty, wow, and Being Julia opposite Annette Bening & Co.
She's fun in that too. That's very Little Dorrit-esque casting of like a busybody woman, yeah.
Yeah. The same year, though, we see her in the perhaps best film of her career, teaming up with the dame power duo that is Judi Dench and Maggie Smith for Charles Dance's Ladies in Lavender, where she plays Dorcas. Is that her name?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't really... All I remember is Daniel Brühl referring to her as a sack of potatoes. You know, they're...
Yes. And... I thought you meant maybe off screen in an interview.
Well, he might have too. It might have been improv. Charles like, what do you really think of Miriam?
Ladies in Lavender tells the story of...
Ladies. Do they ever wear lavender?
They certainly do on the cover of the DVD.
Well, that cover is rotten.
Oh, that's
like a
so
that's like sorry, I'm gonna stop because that's really unfair. After I've badmouthed J.K. Rowling, that's fine, but I'm not gonna badmouth Charles Dance.
No, please stop. Let me tell you
it's
what it's about
cover.
For those who haven't seen
lovely.
It.
Lovely lavender.
The Ladies in Lavender, wearing lavender, is about two sisters, played by guess who, Judy and Maggie, who. Live together in
lesbian.
Kind of a
no, they are real sisters, aren't they?
Yes, in a house in a small Cornish town. That's in Cornwall for those of you who do not know that. And one day, a man washes up on the beach. A young, attractive man, played by Daniel Brühl, and they take him in as they try to work out how it is he has come to be there. Judy Dench's character starts to develop an infatuation for the man, and we see how the dynamics swirl and change based on this infatuation and the developing relationship that comes from a woman who happens to be passing by one day as he is playing beautifully on the violin.
Yeah, the most beautiful, like Natasha Elhorn, is that?
Yes.
Elhoun?
Yes.
She feels like someone who's really famous when I was younger. Anyway, absolutely gorgeous woman.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel Brühl, who I'm not such, like, if I had someone wash up on shore, it wouldn't be him. But, I mean, if you don't choose these things. They just happen to you.
Plenty attractive. He is attractive.
Yeah, he's lovely. You can see why two... people like Judy Dench and Maggie Smith who have not had a man in their life in a long time, if ever,
yeah.
are very eager to keep hold of this man. I'm making it sound like Misery, which is what I would prefer if it was a bit like more sort of like we need to keep this man in the house.
Well, sure, that would be exciting on a different level.
But this is pleasant. This is the most pleasant thing, do you know? It's a very pleasant drama.
It is,
it's a Sunday
it
thing.
It is pleasant, yeah. But
and we haven't even mentioned Miriam.
Yes. So Miriam plays Dorcas. She's the... What would you even call... Like a housemaid?
Housekeeper. Yeah, she's a housekeeper. Yeah. So they must be in money.
Yeah, they're definitely rich spinsters.
Good heavens, what's going on here?
Dorcas, we have a visitor. It's the spare room, madam.
I'll do it, Miss Janet.
This way, Mr. Pendred. And we have to go straight up the stairs.
You can get out for a start. I was talking to the magpie.
Dorcas, you should have been more polite.
Oh, get on with it.
She is the housekeeper, so we see her peeling potatoes, as we've described.
Being attacked by sheep.
Trying to get past sheep.
In the best scene of the movie.
It is a wonderful scene. To be honest, in this, she's having a great time, and she's very fun whenever she's on screen.
Yeah.
And there's a really lovely moment at the end, which involves a lot of people gathering around a wireless. And after seeing her being so sort of firm and earthy and, again, sort of curmudgeonly, kind of things that maybe feel familiar in the Miriam world, she really beams with pride in this loveliness that I found very, very sweet. So I very much enjoyed watching her in this.
Mm.
I don't, unless I'm mistaken, I don't think you enjoy this film as much as I do. I really do enjoy this film a lot.
Yeah.
And I do think that Judy and Maggie are very good in it. I think especially Maggie as the kind of more stoic of the two, I think is great. But that said with a lot of bias as well. But it's just for me, I enjoy being this world. I've seen it quite a lot of times now, Ladies in Lavender. So I'm a fan. Obviously, I don't think it's the greatest thing ever made, but I enjoy it and I think Miriam is wonderful to watch.
Yeah, she's doing exactly what's asked of her.
Yes.
I do like it. Do you know... because there's no point saying, like, I do, it's a fine movie for those who want to get something out of it.
Sure.
But what it made me think of is a TV show I am obsessed with, Cranford, which Judi Dench also plays, oh, like a slightly naive older woman that lives with her sister, this time played by Eileen Atkins, who is also very stern. And it's just like set in this town and all these things. And I really love that. So that's my, it's a bit, I guess what I'd say is a bit more jolly than Ladies in Lavender. I feel like Ladies in Lavender, for me, is I just wish it was less sincere.
That's
because
fair.
I think that's where I come down of, I don't think, I've watched it twice now because I want to rewatch it for this. And that's okay. Do you know, and I would love if Charles Dance like pulled out of the bag an amazing movie.
Mm, yeah.
But
like his body, like his amazing body at the ages. Have you seen it? Very impressive.
So Charles, we are thinking of the same man, right?
Yeah,
Charles Dance,
honestly,
the guy from Game of Thrones.
Yeah. It's very
what, today.
Surprising. Yeah.
Today. You've seen it today. Okay, guys. Well, that is the main. If you don't watch, you may not watch Age of Innocence. You may not watch Ladies in Lavender, but please
Google
Charles Dance's body.
Charles
I'm okay for
getting
that.
Out of the sea with his.
Well, maybe I prefer him
wife.
Than Daniel Brühl washing up then.
You may well do when you see this image. Mm. okay, Ladies in Lavender. There we go. Watch it if you wish. Okay, I'm going to sort of trot through a few more bits and pieces here. So, 2005, we see Margulies return to Dickens once more. This is one of the BBC documentaries titled Dickens in America, where she retraces Dickens' 1842 journey across America. 2006, we have her in another George Miller film, Happy Feet, so more voice work in George Miller work, and also as one of the characters in Aardman's Flushed Away. 2006 as well, very interesting for her, and I totally forgot this. She starred in the original London cast of Wicked as Madame Morrible, which she would reprise on Broadway in 2008. But I thought it was fun that she was the OG for London. So,
do you think Michelle Yeoh now, who's playing in the movie, is on her hit list?
It's been like, yeah, maybe it's like that devil. Why can I not do this now? But yeah, fun. More West End work from her. 2009, Caesar starring in a revival of Samuel Beckett's Endgame. And then 2012, this is where we see her reteam with Babs once again in the Seth Rogen, also starring The Guilt Trip. So you're saying you're a big fan of this film?
I love this movie. Well, I'm a sucker for, like, you know, mother-child films anyway, but there's something really endearing. I think Barbara Streisand is not on our screens enough anymore.
Fair.
And she's wonderful. There's this really wonderful moment where he's telling her to stop bringing out, she's trying to sell these like as something that hangs off your bag. So like as a weight and you put it on the top of the table and then your bag can hang from it.
Okay.
And he's a businessman trying to sell stuff. And she, without thinking, pulls out this hook and puts the bag on. And the person that Seth Rogen's trying to sell to only wants to talk about Barbara Streisand's hook. She's like, I got it in the stall. It was amazing. And I was like, do you know what? There's something. Like, she's discovering herself, which is also a horror movie I love, while also forming this new relationship with her son, who is now grown up and, you know, for some reason is detached from her. So, yeah. Miriam, barely in it. So that's why we wouldn't have watched it for this.
Yeah.
But really fun. I feel like Rita Wilson's in it too, but that could be a lie. I'm probably confusing it. It's Complicated and The Guilt Trip, because she is, Rita Wilson is definitely in It's Complicated as one of Meryl's friends.
Yeah.
So anyway, I really recommend another movie here.
There we go. Gosh, racking them up today. 2016. This is where we see BBC really starting to cash in on that viral success of Miriam on television, probably from the likes of The Graham Norton Show and This Morning. So she is added to the cast of The Real Marigold Hotel, which we've discussed, and The Real Marigold Hotel on Tour, which allowed her to visit a host of countries with a cast of later-yeared celebrities, we'll call them.
Old. Jokes. No, I don't think they are. I think
not necessarily.
Yeah, it depends what your definition of old is.
I think they're probably for.
No, but they're all over 50, but I don't think there's some like that are like 55.
But yeah, fun moments, get on YouTube, you will have a chuckle. We would then see a variety of other shows sort of this nature. So it becomes a bit of a trend, and this is really what the kind of work that we are getting from Miriam. And good for her. She's getting to travel the globe, be funny on TV, and hopefully make a good buck in the process. So We have her in Miriam's Big American Adventure, Miriam's Dead Good Adventure, Miriam's Big Fat Adventure, Miriam Margolyes, Almost Australian, Miriam and Alan, Lost in Scotland, which paired her with Alan Cummings, and then we also have Australia Unmasked. So lots of them. So, you know, really, really cashing in on that. 2018 sees her voice Queen Ufifa in another Aardman film, Early Man. This is also when she started starring in Call the Midwife. And this is, for people familiar with Miriam, may remember her being on an interview on This Morning and saying she really wanted to work on it. And then they put out this sort of like,
no way.
Like, if anyone's listening who works on Call the Midwife who's willing to cast Miriam, can we do it?
Yeah.
And then it happens, and she's now been a series regular playing basically like the Mother Superior nun.
It's a nun story. Call the Midwife.
Well,
I don't know what this is.
She plays a nun in Call the Midwife.
I've never seen this film or show, but that's amazing.
Yeah, and she loved it so much. She got to work on it, and she's had a blast working on
it. Is that Sally Rainwhite? No.
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 Ignore me. That means nothing to most people, too. But anyway, I've never engaged with Call the Midwife, and now I'm interested. No, if Miriam wants to be part of it,
then it must be something. In
playing a nun. This is wild to me.
He's really struck by this one. 2019 sees her playing Miss Shepherd in a Melbourne production of The Lady in the Van, so she really can't shake Maggie Smith's shadow.
Alan Bennett is in Little Dorrit. Sorry, Alan Bennett
really?
Wrote Ladies in a Van.
Yeah.
And I'm just making this connection for no reason, but maybe, like, I bet she's in that circle of people.
Right.
So again, I wouldn't be surprised. She's actually maybe a better fit for that role in Ladies in a Van.
She probably,
I think that would be way more interesting. I don't believe Maggie Smith ever spends a night in that.
I do actually, in that film, but in the film, naturally.
But
it feels like she would nail that part. Yeah,
I think Miriam. Anyway,
and her just walking up in your driveway in a van, you would be a bit like, what's
exactly.
Going?
Whereas Maggie Smith, you'd be like, of course you can use my
come
bathroom.
In.
I think that's where it is. Where if she asks for you to use the bathroom, we're like, of course she can.
Yeah.
Do you know, like, anyway,
it's Maggie.
That's another. Yeah, Maggie can do whatever she likes.
Yeah, exactly. And then if we just look at the kind of the last few years, so in 2021, riding on this wave of popularity, she's released her autobiography titled This Much Is True. And for anyone who's a fan of listening to her talk, there is also the audiobook version you can enjoy. And then this year, 2023, I hadn't ever heard of this, but she is in an Andy McDowell-led film called My Happy Ending.
A sex-positive movie, I'm assuming.
So it seems like it probably is a sex-positive movie. I hope it is. If it's not already out, can't wait. If it is...
Well, Andy McDowell, what was that called? That really great show on The Maid, was it?
Maid.
I feel like we're going to have her... She's going to have a moment where she is being re-recognized in... her status, and like, you know, like, people won't be so quick to dismiss her. She was wonderful in Maid.
McDowellissance. Can't wait.
Exactly.
You've
heard it here first when she wins an Oscar for My Happy Ending.
Yeah, it's coming. And then looking to the future, there's a few credits upcoming, but I guess the most significant at the moment to my eye is the eagerly anticipated 60th anniversary special of Doctor Who.
Amazing, she's in that.
Mm.
God, they're really racking up the cast. And a lot of queer people.
Yeah.
Jonathan Groff.
That's right.
That's the only person that's come
there
to mind.
Go. But then we're going to get the new Doctor, who also is leading the charge in queer representation in Doctor Who, and then the return of Russell T Davies. So yeah, lots of good things for that world.
Yeah, sorry, I confused it. So she's not in Russell T Davies' version?
She ought to be.
Well, hopefully she carries over. That's what I meant. Sorry, I didn't realise we're still stuck with your man.
Yeah.
David Tennant, is it?
Yes, I believe
that's
correct.
Been doing years. Anyway, Miriam, I'm just so glad to have spent so much time. I'm really just glad to have watched Age of Innocence for the amount of times I have. No, I think it's been really wonderful thinking about her. She's someone in my head I'm like casually like, yeah, I would give her any role she wanted. And now looking at her work, I'm like, God, she's had such a great career in many ways and got to peppered in like tiny roles like Little Shop of Horrors, two amazing, like what should be remembered forever, Age of Innocence, to then just having a fun time filming with Charles Dance and Dames in sure. Ladies in Lavender. She also pops up in Magnolia, which we have not mentioned, in a very brief scene at the beginning. Wonderful being chaired. Isn't she tied to a chair and like screaming because the John C. Reilly's trying to figure out stuff. Anyway.
Yeah, but she's uncredited. Why was she uncredited in that film?
Because I think she's just so brief. Yeah. Okay. I don't know why she wasn't credited. Yeah. But anyway. I'm really glad. So thank you, Scott, because I feel like you've been like her cheerleader in terms of what's doing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I will, any time that she's available to sort of watch, I will certainly watch and laugh and enjoy. I think she is a unique, truly unique presence in British.
Again, I think Beyoncé's Renaissance is about Miriam.
Yeah, it might be. Renaissance. There's so much connections here. But she is a unique presence, certainly in British pop culture. But as a performer, I can't think of anyone else like her. As an individual, I can't think of anyone else like her.
Do you know
her.
Who actually popped to mind?
Go on.
But Magda Subansky. She plays the farmer's wife in Babe and Babe 2.
Okay,
and also
yeah.
A lot of people will know her from Kath and Kim,
right.
Where she plays Sharon. I'm only saying in terms of like the humour and the sort of...
Yeah, okay.
I really wish she got more too.
Yeah.
Being queer, being, you know, brilliant, being funny, being stand-up, just being great themselves. But yeah, I do... Miriam, in terms of a British example, I don't think there are... Certainly in theatre, I guess there are people like her, but not in such a mainstream
not
way.
Not in the way that she is now so known. I think it's just a combination of lots with her. She is a unique package, shall we say, in terms of her energy.
Mm.
But it was very fun to reflect on her, read more about her, her stories, listen to her chatting, always good. And rewatching some of these films, an absolute treat for me. Thinking about what we'd like from her in the future... Does anything spring to your mind?
Well, I'm going to stick with what I said earlier. I'm doing A Christmas Carol with Miriam, a Scrooge, directed by David Fincher. Because I was like, who the fuck else?
Okay, well, bold choice. But I mean, I just think in any, like, even doing that for like a Christmas TV special on the BBC or something, I think it would be perfect. She literally just feels... absolutely right and perfect for the role of Scrooge. Like, it's so her.
Or the other thing could be Barbie too, if they make a theater. Like, she could be some really fun person. I don't know what the first Barbie's going to be like, but...
No, that I could see that too. I mean, what I put down, because she's renowned for being mischievous and someone who I think kind of can embrace that, but also work with it in a kind of very unusual, often... can be sinister-edged way, is Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yeah.
I can see her... Like, if we think of The Favourite, for example, in the sort of energy that we saw Olivia Colman bringing to her role, I would like to see Miriam getting to play grotesque type in a similar way.
But in a more respectful way. That's one thing I'll say about her career. It's really frustrating to watch somebody be pigeonholed the whole time for how they look, and also making them even more grotesque than, like... she seems to think about herself. So, yeah, I agree. That would be wonderful to match with someone like Yorgos Lanthimos, who would be able to do that in a really interesting way.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would be wonderful to see. So,
or at least the best Exotic Marigold Hotel 3.
There we go. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, why is that not happening? But I guess Maggie and Judy don't want to travel to India again.
They're probably the only reason that it wouldn't be happening.
Do you think they keep every so often Fox, whoever's behind us, like... what about this summer?
They're like, no.
Anyway, as always, Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Where can people find us if they want to chat to us on social media and tell us how much they love Ladies in Lavender?
We welcome such conversations. You can get us on Twitter and Instagram at don'tknowher_pod. Or if you feel restricted by the character allowance on there, you can drop us an email at don'tknowherpod@gmail.com.
Now, if we got an essay, I'd absolutely love that. Tell me why I'm wrong about Age of Innocence. Because I'm sure there must be people that don't like it if it didn't do that well when it was originally released. And please do rate, review us wherever you listen to us. That really helps other people find us. And as always, I'd ask you to share on with one other person who you think might enjoy listening to us ramble on about kind of underappreciated icons of cinema.
Yeah, we would love that. But thank you for listening once again, everyone.
And thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Michael. And have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.